good afternoon and welcome to Ask the Mayor on WBAA. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. In studio with me this week is Lafayette Mayor Tony Rozworski. If you've got a question for him during our next half hour, we'd love to have it. Our telephone number is 496-1999, our email ask@wbaa.org, and you can always tweet your questions to @WBAAnews on Twitter. Well, I want to start with a couple of local questions I got that are sort of related to each other. One person asked me to ask you about the status of the sort of rough railroad crossings along Kossuth and Farabee streets. The Kossuth and Earl location is now sort of a large bump, even though it's been nicely repaved. And then the one just across 52, where Kossuth turns into Farabee, is very rough. All vehicles kind of have to slow down to get across it. So both of those are sort of slowing traffic down, and this person wanted to know what, if anything, can be done about that.
Well, we're waiting for the railroad to come back and fix the Kossuth Street tracks there. As the caller indicated, it's absolutely correct. One side of the crossing is low and just about right to grade, and the other half of the lane is considerably higher than it needs to be. And so we have asked the railroad. They fixed that and did that when their train derailed there, the caboose that derailed, and they came back and repaired that. We've asked them several times to come back and to lower that section there because it is too high. Haven't got a time frame from them yet, but we'll continue with those inquiries because we know that it does need to be lowered, but that would be their responsibility to fix that. So that's the one that's really high. And Farabee, we can certainly take a look at that, see what needs to be done there, see if it's something that the city could make a little bit better, or again, if it's going to be one where the railroad would need to come in because it involves the actual tracks and things between the tracks that they're supposed to work on and not us, but we'll certainly see. But on Kossuth, we do want folks to know that we've made numerous inquiries for the railroad to come back and lower that portion. We're not really allowed to work on that piece and to do something that if we tried to lower it, that would affect their track. So we've got to be very cautious about us doing anything, and hopefully here in the near future they'll get back to lower that.
You mentioned that caboose derailment. That actually leads into a question we got online from Brian Conover, who says, in light of the recent increase in rail accidents in the last 10 years or so across the country, specifically in residential areas, and he mentions trains carrying flammable, combustible, or other hazardous materials, he says, what steps have you and the city taken to keep neighborhoods safe?
Well, fortunately for us, with railroad relocation, those tracks that carry those the hazardous materials, the tracks that carry those types of combustibles run through that rail corridor that doesn't run through the hearts of our community and bisect all of our neighborhoods anymore. It comes in, as you know, from the south and down through Reilly Plaza, and then it has that corridor that gets it pretty quickly out to by Tate and Lyle and on out of the tracks. So that's been a huge benefit since railroad relocation is done. Obviously, all those crossings are gated and meet standards. We have a hazmat team that does train here repeatedly in case there would be an incident. But the railroad relocations played a big role. The spur lines that kind of go through town still, that go from Tate and Lyle north up through Alcoa on that spur line we talked about right there, traveled at very, very slow speeds, and they mostly move metal shavings and things like that. They're not carrying, you know, the other products. Those are products stay on that rail corridor. So those lines there carry a different type of material, and that's why when that derailed, nothing happened. You know, we had to stand it back up and fix the tracks, but because it's a different type of spur line that's used for movement of different types of materials.
This is something that's come up with a lot of municipal governments in recent years, is people don't want trains carrying the hazardous materials to go through their towns. There's been this sort of not in my backyard mm-hmm. that we've heard from mayors all over the country. Do you ever get notified by companies that say, hey, we want to bring potentially hazardous chemicals through town? What do you think about that? Or do they just kind of have carte blanche to do it?
Yeah, no, we don't get notified. You know, that's a relationship with the railroad, and the railroad has certain rights all across the United States, where they have tracks to move goods and commerce and different types of materials. And so, no, we don't get any notice personally. And there's a lot of things that move through the community on a daily basis, moving from one part of the country to the next, and with all the business and industry. So, you know, we don't get notified of that. And again, that's why I'm very happy that we have a designated rail corridor through the community. And as you know, we used to have many intersections and trains that transverse through many neighborhoods and by shopping centers and everything else. And fortunately, with railroad relocation, a lot of that was taken care of.
While we're broadly on the subject of transportation, I talked with John Dennis in this program last week about NDOT's road relinquishment program. And I had an interesting conversation with him, and one of our reporters then called a spokesman for NDOT. And John said, I'd be okay with taking back some of these roads as long as NDOT goes and fixes them first. And he's referencing specifically 52, which is in kind of rough shape through both of your communities. And then when we called the NDOT spokesman, he said that's an interesting philosophy, because we talked to other mayors and they say we'd rather just have the money so that we can fix the road how we see fit. Mm-hmm. So I thought I'd ask you where in that sort of timeline you come down. Would you rather take the road back over once it's nice as far as NDOT says, or would you rather have the cash and the city of Lafayette can do whatever you want to do to the road?
Well, we did a hybrid of that when we took over Sagamore Parkway in Lafayette. The agreement, the relinquishment agreement that the city of Lafayette entered into with NDOT was again a hybrid of that. NDOT redid the road and fixed the road to brand new standards from the bridge there at the Wabash River as you're coming down the big hill from West Lafayette into Lafayette, up to Beach Drive. And that kind of gets us through the more industrial area there, got us past Tate and Lyle's concrete. And it kind of has that state highway design feel to it, which was, we were okay with that right there. And there wasn't a lot of drainage issues that had to be rectified. From the portion from Beach Drive to Teal Road, We wanted to design that differently. We wanted to make that an urban thoroughfare corridor. So we want islands in the middle. We wanted to fix all the drainage. We want different street lights. We want trails and sidewalks. We want pull off for public transportation for buses. So for that section from Beach Drive up to 300 feet north of McCarty Lane, we took money. And so we were given $20 million for that section. And for that, then we've designed that section ourselves, and we'll build it ourselves to the standards, to the looks, fix the drainage the way we want it fixed ourselves. From the section 300 feet north of McCarty Lane to Teal Road, we entered back into an agreement with the state where they would put in $3 million of federal highway funds to help do that section and anything above and beyond that we wanted to do, because we do want to do some stuff above and beyond that. Again, so it's a more urban section. We want to fix some drainage. We want to do some things that help Wabash National, that help the Earl Avenue system and things like that. So we entered into a hybrid agreement for that section too. So I did a little of both. I had them pay and fix some of it and give it to us brand new. I took the money for a certain section that we wanted to do what we wanted to do, the way we wanted to do it. And then on the third section, again, a little bit of a hybrid, some of their money, some of our money, with us having the authority to do the design and the drainage the way that we felt was best for Lafayette and to help with some of our surrounding businesses.
Did you find them relatively responsive to your wanting to kind of do this piece by piece and have each road or each road section taken by its own self?
It took years. It took years of negotiation to get to that point, to where we were finally able to enter into an agreement and reach a dollar amount that everybody could agree on. So it was a long negotiation, but we got there. I guess that's the best way I can describe it. It was long, but we got there. But we feel very good about it for the city of Lafayette. In fact, from Beach Drive to 300 feet to the first section up to about Home Depot. That's been put out to bid, came back in at $10.5 million. So we're working right now, putting in a brand new water main before we start tearing up the road. And the utilities will still be moved this winter. So we hope in the spring the actual road work will begin. And so the first part of that we have put out to bid. It was awarded to Reith Riley. They were the low bidder at $10.5 million. And so construction, at least water main going in, has actually started out there.
And do you have a timeline on whole new road?
Well,
optimistically?
Yeah, that section from Beach Drive up to the entrance to the Home Depot is where this contract is at. Probably two construction seasons, so probably about 2 years total, depending on the weather. Right now, we've got a pretty mild winter, so today they were still putting asphalt trail down up along Earl Avenue on the Earl Avenue Durkee's Run project, and it actually poured some additional concrete on some of these warm days. So
they're getting a little ahead of schedule, potentially.
Well, that's that on that project, helping us do some things that we thought we'd had to stop on by now this time of year. So hopefully some of the warm weather continues and we'd get all that water main in the next couple months and the utilities moved. And when spring got here, we'd be on schedule.
This is Ask the Mayor on WBAA. We're chatting with Lafayette Mayor Tony Rozworski. Give us your phone calls at 496-1999. Send email to ask@WBAA.org or tweet your questions to @WBAAnews on Twitter. We talked a little bit last month about the city trying to get people to help corral feral cats. I wanted to touch base with you again and see how it's going getting people signed up for that.
Well, I don't know off the top of my head. I didn't check this morning to see how many people had.
You mean you don't get a weekly update?
No. We got a lot of big projects going. So I don't know exactly how many people have signed up for that, but I certainly haven't had any complaints come in that it's not going well or that somebody is unhappy with something that's taken place so far. You know, still pretty early in the process, getting people acclimated, getting people to learn what's going on. But, I think, again, we're moving in the right direction, and we did do the big fix, and I don't have any number for you on how many animals have been spayed and neutered so quick. I'll try to bring some figures for you next month, and we'll see where we're at. But I really feel good that we're in all aspects of animal control, doing the right thing for the animals and the citizens. I really feel good that in all the things that we're doing, we're moving in the right direction.
Earlier this week, just to change topic, you did your annual shop with the mayor with some kids, and this is clearly a really nice thing for you to do for them. I was curious, though, to learn from you what you learn about the kids and about their situations and about your community from doing this on a yearly basis.
You know, it's very touching and very moving to do that. We have kids that come from all walks of life, facing all kinds of different struggles and challenges and different things that are going on in their life. And so I see kids that are just smiling from ear to ear. I see kids that have bought their first bike. I see kids that buy clothes and coats because they need the clothing more than they need the toys. I see kids that buy for their siblings or another family member that they think might not get a Christmas gift, and so they buy something for them. My wife reminded me when we were there this week that last year we had a youngster that bought it was a little rabbit or some kind of bunny, I forget, some kind of little stuffed animal. And my wife had inquired, well, that's cute. That's nice. That's something you wanted. And they said, well, I actually am buying this for my mom to make sure my mom gets a gift this Christmas too. And so you hear those kind of stories that sometimes you do forget about. I think, Stan, you put it very well. What can tell you sometimes about a community or what people are going through? You know, we don't always think about that. Most kids have plenty at Christmas and lots of opportunities from their family and grandparents. But, you know, a lot of kids don't have that extended network and parents could be struggling. And so, you know, we really appreciate being able to do it. We couldn't do it without our sponsors. In particular, we have some very big with Wabash National, and Bob Rohrman, really step forward and help us make that day special for a lot of kids.
Does it give you an opportunity to not just learn more about those families, but stay in touch with them at all. And if you see that there is somebody who could use a little extra attention, another friend here and there, does it give you that opportunity to develop that sort of relationship?
You know, we those kids, they remember that event forever. I was over here at Purdue last week reading at the Christmas party that was put on for the kids that are in the College Mentors for Kids program here at Purdue. And I was reading the night before Christmas, and I was amazed at how I did three groups, how many of them kids said, "Hey, Mayor, I went to shop with Mayor with you." And so I got a chance to talk to him. I see him in a lot of the schools that I'm at. And then, you know, the way that we get those kids, too, I think is important. We work with the Boys and Girls Club, the Bauer Center, Big Brothers and Big Sisters, Hannah. We look for military families, and we look for families that we know are in a difficult spot, but also that have maybe not had the opportunity to be in other programs that for one reason or another, you know, they haven't had a chance to get some help. And so we look for those people that haven't had that opportunity. And so, you know, we hope that we're just spreading a little bit of cheer and letting those kids know not just that they're getting a gift, but that the community cares about them, and that there are people here in the community that want them to be happy, and they care about them.
Moving on from the holiday season into what's going to go on in January, particularly at the State House, one of the things that's of local interest to a lot of people here is we're coming up on yet another deadline for Amtrak at the end of January, and I know that you and the other mayors along the corridor have been working with the state and working with the governor's office. It's been a while since I've had a chance to ask you about it. Is there anything new on getting another agreement in place?
Well, we're at a very precarious time right now in the Hoosier State continuing in our community. As you're well aware, the negotiations with Corridor Capital and NDOT have broke down. And so now they are working with Amtrak to see if there's a potential for a partnership between Amtrak, Iowa Pacific, and NDOT, where Amtrak would still be the operator of the train, the engine, the caboose, some of those functions, but that Iowa Pacific would help with some of the other things, some of the amenities like the Wi-Fi, the food, the marketing, how we ticket, maybe some special promotional trains and some things like that that would help with ridership, that would help with even maybe on-time performance. So those discussions are continuing, like I said, no longer with Corridor Capital, but now back with Amtrak and Iowa Pacific. The reality is we are running out of time. I am still cautiously optimistic that an agreement will be reached. I think passenger rail service is important for the community. I do believe it has to be improved on time performance, amenities, those types of things. But I think if that could happen, ridership really would go up. And so I'm hoping we can continue it, and NDOT will continue to view rail transportation as part of its overall transportation planning.
So it sounds like as the discussions went along, you felt that it would be good to bring in some outside actors like Iowa Pacific to try to say maybe we can inject some more new blood into this process and thus keep it going.
Yeah, I mean, we looked at we went through an RFP and an RFQ process for other train operators to have the ability to participate, to look at the operations of the train. Obviously, Amtrak is the current operator and have many of the track agreements in place. And so I think it's fairly clear to all of us that Amtrak has to have some involvement in this process. And certainly we would welcome Amtrak's involvement in the process with somebody else involved also too. If that's the combination that's important to make the train successful, I can tell you from the local elected officials, that's our goal. We want the train to be successful. We want it to eventually to get where it's self-supporting, where it has the ridership that it needs to be, where it's efficient, it's fast, the food is good, the Wi-Fi, and that it actually is amenity for helping keep and attract talent to our community. We keep helping people get back and forth to those destinations to make this a more attractive place to live, to work, to start a business, because you know you have that easy rail service. And so that's our goal. It's for us, it's really about economic development, creating jobs and keeping talent here in our community.
We've got just a few minutes left with Lafayette Mayor Tony Rozworski on Ask the Mayor today on WBAA. You can call us with your question at 496-1999. Email ask@WBAA.org or our Twitter handle is WBAA News. You can send us a message there. Purdue's leaders yesterday went to the State Budget Committee and laid out their capital projects ask. And it occurred to me that I should ask you, are there any things that the city of Lafayette is in a position to go to the state legislature when the session begins next month and advocate for on your own behalf?
Well, one of the things that we'll be talking about, and not just the city of Lafayette, but local leaders throughout the state, I think, and mayors working with the Indiana Association of Cities and Towns is, you know, legislation that might affect our tax increment finance district. So that is a tool that we have for economic development that is absolutely critical for us. You know, we have used TIF to help with the $400 million expansion that's happening right now at the Subaru plant. We have TIF dollars involved in getting the new GE Jet Aviation facility here. And the list just goes on and on with big businesses, small businesses, road projects. And so we've been already started talking to our legislators about the TIF districts, and you know, we don't want to see any legislation that hampers our ability to use those and to use them quickly to react at the speed of business.
Are you hearing that there might be legislation coming down the pike?
Every year there is always some legislation that deals with TIF. It's kind of a continual process. Some folks understand the importance of TIF. Others, communities may not use it as much. So there's people concerned if it could be abused or has been abused in the past. And so just about every legislative session, you will hear some discussion about TIF. And there have been changes over the last couple years regarding a school board member now sits on the Redevelopment Commission because the Redevelopment Commission handles the TIF budgets. Been changes to the law regarding bonding and oversight by the city council over the Redevelopment Commission as you go through the bonding process and some things like that. And I think all of those things are fine. There should be accountability. I believe in accountability and being good stewards of the taxpayers' money. But we don't want to lose any ability to use it quickly on economic development. Like I said, every major project that you've seen here in Lafayette has some TIF component to it. And then smaller projects like for downtown and road and water and sewer projects to help make connections. And so, you know, that's where a lot of our focus will be. Look at the overall budget, how it affects funding for education, and then also funding for local roads and streets. Obviously, that continues to be an issue for all of us, is making sure that there's funds available, that we can get the infrastructure in that we need. And so all those things will kind of be on our radar. But for me, you know, TIF is going to be one of the things that I'm watching close, because we've used it successfully here. We have great opportunity. We have great things going on, and I think we've got great opportunities for the future. We've got a lot of inquiries in our community, and we're looking at developing new lands to open up for development to create new jobs of all different levels and all different types, and we want to continue to be able to do that for our citizens.
I want to say to our listeners, just in our role as civic educators here, if they've not come across tax increment financing, you should go Google it and learn about it, because it really is an important municipal tool. There was a number came out recently that says that the tax caps that are now in place for about 6 years now are worth about $600 million. And you can look at that a couple of different ways. That's either $600 million more dollars back in taxpayers' pockets, or $600 million fewer dollars that have been collected by the state and subsequently given back to local budgets like your own. I wanted to check in with you now that we are fully invested in this tax cap financing structure. What is it doing these days to the city's budget? Are you still shrunk down to the point where you're not able to do some of the things you want to do, or have you kind of learned to live with the new lower financing?
Well, I mean, we it still affects us. Each year is a little bit different, but you know, we lose about $1.5 million a year to property tax caps, and as you framed it very well. I mean, it's a kind of a double-edged sword. Certainly, we want to keep as much money in people's pockets as we humanly can to spend in our community. Those dollars rolling over help to drive the economy. People can buy cars and wash machines and go to the doctor and do all those things. So we understand the importance of that. The biggest challenge for us is that money, almost all of it comes right out of the general fund. And so that is primarily the police and fire departments. So those become some of our biggest challenges there is, you know, to ensure that we're able to fund that public safety mechanism, because the biggest chunk of that affects public safety. But we continue to find ways to do it. Fortunately for us, one of the things that we do is we continue to grow. As you create jobs, as you create economic opportunity, then other funds can go up, such as COET and EDIT, and help offset some of that a little bit by creating more jobs, expanding that tax base to even it out. So we'll continue to do that and be good stewards of the taxpayers' money.
You mentioned COET and EDIT, and there's been talk at the state level that there are many local option income taxes that have not been local option taxes of all sorts that have not been adopted by counties since the property tax went into effect. And there were some lawmakers who said, look, we'll give you this opportunity to raise revenue in this way, but then you get back to the discussion of who gets to be the bad guy. Is it the local taxing authority or is it the state? How have you been involved in that sort of discussion about making people understanding of this is where the revenue comes from to pay for paving your streets and having a police force? And, you know, it's not about who gets blamed. It's about making sure that there are civic services.
Sure. Well, you know, from a personal standpoint, I'll always err on the side of local control. So if we can get local control and we have to take the I hate to say take the blame, but if we have to do the explaining locally why we did something or raise revenue, I would always err on the side of go ahead, the state giving us that opportunity, and we'll take the responsibility for that. I think that's leadership, and you have to lead. So, you know, we did that when we implemented the wheel tax several years ago. And you know, at the time, a lot of people were not in favor of that. I think most people have now seen that we've used that very wisely. The amount of roads that's been paved that we wouldn't have been able to pave without that is significant. So I'll always err on the side of local control so we can make those decisions locally.
Just real quick, there's also been talk about giving cities the opportunity to levy more of these, whereas counties have traditionally had most of the local taxing authority. Would you like more authority for the city itself?
Well, you know, we work very well with the county here, and I would prefer things to be countywide. Certainly, city control might be very appropriate for certain targeted situations. But, you know, I think when we can do things as a county, I think that's always best for us. We continue that sense of cooperation, working together, planning together, allocating resources together is a good way for us to go.
All right, Mr. Mayor, thanks for your time. Happy holidays.
Thank you too, Stan. Thank you.
And thanks for listening to Ask the Mayor here on WBAA. You can find all of these shows at our website, WBAA.org. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Have a good rest of your day.